Good morning and welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, Workforce Development for Wednesday, February 4th. We have a quick work session to introduce the committee measure, and then we're on to our continuing conversation about the state of higher education. I'll open a work session on the introduction of committee measures. Representative Johnson.
Chair Reed, I move that LC 3662, dated 1/27/15, be introduced as a committee bill.
Thank you. Representative Johnson has moved that legislative concept 3662, dated 1/27/15, be introduced as a committee bill. Once again, support of this motion does not indicate any support of the bill. Should it come back to this committee, and should it move forward with that? Any discussion of the motion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. Legislative concept 3662 is introduced as a committee bill, and we'll close the work session and open an informational hearing on cost trends in higher education. Mr. Cannon, thanks for coming back, and please feel free to bring anyone up with you. I know we have several people who are going to speak today. We have three chairs, but we can at least start with two of you. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Glad to be back today. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and joined by Bob Brew, who's the Director of our Office for Student Access and Completion. I'll kick off. I have a few slides. I don't know if you've got that up to introduce this. So your committee today focused on cost and cost trends. As the commission, we think about cost, and we immediately think about students and the costs that they bear. So that's to a large extent how I've framed the remarks that I'll make today. So we've taken this question of cost and are connecting it to affordability and really what students experience in paying for higher education. I'll just note here at the outset that affordability and this issue of unaffordability, if you will, has really become the primary priority for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and clearly to the commission stands in the way of achieving our 40-40-20 goals. As we've worked on it over the past year, however, one of the things that's become very clear to the commission is that the affordability problem is not a simple one. There are multiple dimensions to affordability. Affordability is not the same thing as tuition. And so what I'll attempt to do over the next several minutes is just try to bring forward some of the dimensions of affordability that the commission has begun to wrestle with as we've thought about the types of work that we would do or proposals that we would bring to you this legislative session. So with that, I will move in. So our perspective, and I would guess yours too at the end of the day, is really from the standpoint when it relates to affordability and cost is really a student's perspective. And I think there are three particularly relevant questions to students who are thinking about costs and their families who are thinking about costs and in higher education. One is sort of what am I going to need to spend to earn a degree or certificate or get what I want to get out of higher education. Another is, what do I get for that? What is awarded to me in return for the spending that I do? And finally, how does that pay off? We're going to focus today really on the economics of this, the financial side of this, recognizing again that there are lots of payoffs and lots of rewards that are not strictly financial. But I'd simplify this to say, number one is about cost, number two is about the outcome, and number three is about the earnings. And by outcome, focus specifically on degree or certificate outcome. So I'm going to take a sort of simplified view and walk through some cases. And again, this is going to be sort of grossly oversimplified, but for the purpose of getting our heads around some of the different dimensions of the affordability question. And so I've got a table, and I'll give you four student cases. And I'll just note here that when I'm talking about cost, so what the student spends, I think it's important to note here that cost is not the same thing as price. Okay? The price is the tuition the student is charged, but the cost, I would suggest is not tuition. The cost is actually tuition plus living expenses, but minus grants and scholarships or tuition discounts that help bring down that cost. And I will, for each of these student types, sort of give a sense of whether or not we would call it affordable. So let's take the first case, and this is sort of our worst case. This is the classic example, unfortunately, too common example of a student who experiences high cost. Sorry. That is, their tuition and living expenses minus grants and scholarships is high. Their outcome is not good. So there is not a degree or certificate or award that confers earnings power in the marketplace. Their earnings are not surprisingly low, and we would clearly say that this was not an affordable experience for the student. The second student also pays high cost. And I grant this is highly oversimplified. You have to sort of look at actual numbers to maybe have a deeper conversation about this. But let's just say that the cost that the second student experiences is also high. But they earn a degree. Their earnings are high. And even in today's higher education marketplace, with costs for many students, in fact, quite high, with high earnings, this then is an affordable experience. And so for this, take, for example, to envision this student, perhaps this is your MBA student who borrows for that master's degree. It's the tuition, in fact, is quite high, but the degree itself confers, at least for that student, significant earnings gains. And this borrowing and indebtedness was worth it. And we could say that for that student, in fact, it was an affordable experience. So student three, this is the example that we love, right, and we wish for. This is a low-cost experience, a degree, certificate, award that confers high earnings powers. And clearly, this was a worthwhile investment, and we could call this affordable. Finally, the fourth student, also a low-cost experience, but unsuccessful in earning what he or she sought to earn, low rewards in the workplace, and despite the fact that student perhaps experienced a lower cost higher education, the affordability question still, you know, the living expenses, the potential borrowing for that, the fact that they didn't complete resulted in something we would say is unaffordable. The point here, I think, a few points here. One is that tuition is not the entire story. I just really have to sort of reinforce this, that higher education affordability cannot be understood merely in terms of tuitions. High price does not equal unaffordable, necessarily, and that outcomes and earnings matter in addition to cost, in addition to tuition.
Yes, Representative Gallegos.
I just wanted to point out, I mean, I like that you're thinking in a broader sense in terms of cost, but one other cost factor that you made me think about is, for example, in social work, you can get a bachelor's degree in social work. If it's from an accredited program, you basically can get advanced standing in a master's program, i.e. then you get a master's program in 1 year instead of two, which puts you then in the market at a higher salary rate. So it's another way to think about cost, I guess, is how long people are really in the program.
Representative Gallegos, Chair Reed, that's a terrific point, and one that I'll get to here in a couple of moments. Time to degree is another dimension of this that I did not include, but one that has a huge impact on the cost that a student experiences and the affordability as a result. And I would argue is it may be as important as tuition itself in understanding whether or not higher education is affordable. So cost trends, and this is a simplified version of charts that you've seen before, I'm sure, but this expresses for our public universities the recent history of tuition. And as well as on the green bar, the recent history of Oregon's state need-based aid program, and Bob will speak to that in a few minutes. You'll see here, this is one expression of the extent to which tuition has significantly outpaced at least state need-based aid. Again, these are just sort of one dimension of affordability, but an important one, tuition and state need-based aid. I won't go into any additional detail around this unless there are questions, but I will note that tuition increase here tracks very closely with this decline in state investment in public universities. There's been a very clear cost shifting from the state to students in the form of tuition.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cannon, does the Pell Grant following the same trend as the Green Line for the Opportunity Grant?
To you, Representative McEwen.
Representative Reed, Representative McEwen. Yes, the Pell Grant grows very slowly. It grows about $50 to $100 a year. So,
and I'm
about,
sorry to interrupt, about one producer. So.
I'm
yes,
sorry.
Please. Thank
Pardon
you.
Me. For the record, Bob Brew, Director of the Office of Student Access and Completion.
Thank you.
The Pell Grant grows about $50 to $100 a year. It's very slow. So about 1% in a good year.
So similar trajectory as OOG, higher, lower.
Yes.
Representative Reardon?
I would assume that this is going up at a higher rate than the CPI.
Representative Reardon, Chair Reed, yes, the tuition fees are growing at a much faster rate than CPI. I haven't looked at the OOG numbers in that respect. They're obviously much closer along with Pell. The other thing on Pell to note, if we had included it here, Pell is a much more generous award than the Oregon Opportunity Grant. So for low-income students who receive it, that does it fills much more of the gap created by tuition, but it has not. The increases there, as Bob noted, have not kept up with tuition, nor does tuition alone represent close to the entire costs of higher education.
Please go ahead.
So here's another way to look at cost and the way students are experiencing higher education. And actually, what I want to draw your attention to, this comes back to Representative Gallegos' question. So this expresses average debt at graduation for, again, Oregon's public university students. It's a chart that I pulled from a different presentation that was focused on race and ethnicity. And unfortunately, it doesn't have the overall number here. But actually, the point I really want to illustrate is the fact that students who graduate in 6 years, represented by the teal bars, whether they're American Indian, Alaskan Native students, Hispanic Latino students, or white students, graduate with much more debt than students who graduate in 4 years. And this should not be surprising. They have spent an additional 2 years. And as you'll see in a moment, many of our students are taking much more than 4 years to complete for a variety of reasons, including for some of them choices they've made to attend part-time and work alongside it. But unquestionably, the increased time to degree is resulting in greater costs to students, greater levels of debt, and is, again, to Representative Gallegos's point, is part of what's contributing to the affordability challenge that we have in higher education. If we have managed to keep tuition flat, but students were taking 2 or 3 or 4 years longer to graduate, that would be an affordability problem. In fact, what's occurred is tuition has risen quickly, students are taking longer to graduate, and so we've compounded the problem of student debt. Time to degree matters a lot, as does completion rates. And here, again, drawing on public university data, our completion rates have risen. And there's terrific work that all of our campuses are doing to bring these numbers up. I'll note these are 6-year graduation rates. So, and the 4-year graduation rate is roughly half of the 6-year graduation. So if we were focused on a 4-year, it's in the 30s. I'm sorry I don't have that number precisely, but I believe it's in the 30s. So that helps to express how many students are are taking more than 4 years. But not only that, even at 6 years, it is 60%. And that is not a bad number when you look nationally at like systems of public universities. 60% is nothing that our universities should be embarrassed about from a national standpoint.
Just to make sure I understand the chart, 2007 is the year that
the
that
cohort
start.
Correct.
And so we're looking at the 2013.
Yeah, this is the most recent. Yeah, okay. Thanks for that clarification, Representative Reed. This is the most recent data. And but that still, that's 40% of students who have started. They have paid tuition. Many of them have incurred some debt, or potentially a lot of debt, and they have not completed. Again, helping this type of data and this lens on affordability and cost, helping to really draw the commission's attention not only to state need-based aid, tuition, but also rates of completion and time to degree as key elements, key dimensions of the affordability question. I'll note, too, since the chair asked the institutions to provide their institution-specific completion data, both overall as well as for Pell and non-Pell qualifying students, that the overall, and you'll see some of that data, or you've been provided with some of that data by the institutions, there is overall in our universities about a 12-point gap in the completion rates for 12 for Pell students and non-Pell. So if a student is low-income, eligible for Pell, their likelihood of completing is about 12 points less. The Oregon Opportunity Grant, it turns out, and Bob will address this, makes actually a pretty big impact on bringing that number up. So let's talk about earnings. So these dimensions of affordability that I've walked through, cost, outcomes, and now earnings. And you saw a version of this in my presentation on Monday that relates degree attainment to earnings. Again, here showing a very clear relationship between higher degrees and earnings, helping to illustrate the point that higher education, even costly higher education, may be a very fine investment for a student who completes, particularly in certain degrees, certain fields that are high reward. This slide we won't, it's too small in detail probably to go into very much detail on, but I will provide it just as a taste of the type of data that we have available to us. This is Oregon University graduates by field of study and their earnings for that same 2007 cohort, and their earnings 1 year after graduation, 2 year after graduation, 3, 4, 5 years after graduation, using UI unemployment insurance data.
So the obvious question here, without going into each detail, and I agree we could try to read them, but are there trends you can describe? Is it the hard sciences that are doing better and the social sciences that aren't, or what can you say in general about that?
Chair Reed, the spikes over on the left-hand side are won't surprise anyone, I don't think. Computer and information sciences and engineering technologies are the fields where we see the biggest early gains for students. The different lines here express, again, no surprise, the fact that earnings grow for students between their first and fifth years. There's this data gets a little bit confounded because of the recession. Frankly, these are students who were coming out into the workforce as the recession was beginning. Otherwise, I'm not prepared to try to discern significant trends from this. I will note that the national studies along these lines indicate that this significant premium that computer science and engineering technology students earn in their first years relative to other fields is reduced somewhat over time. That gap that majors in the liberal arts, the humanities, social sciences, et cetera, tends to over the lifetime of over a student's lifetime of earnings, that gap diminishes, and there's even some evidence that liberal arts graduates exceed over a lifetime. But when you talk lifetime, you're talking about students. The data we have are students who were graduating in the 60s or so. A very different economy. So I'm not sure sort of how much to take away from that, except to say that 5 years is probably not a sufficient snapshot for us to really draw a lot of conclusions from this.
I'm sorry. I'm just missing something here. Why are we looking at data from 2007?
Representative Reed and Chair Reed. So these, I believe, and I apologize, this actually is a slightly different, it is a different cohort than the one that we looked at prior. These are students who completed their degrees in 2007, I believe, and it looks at their earnings for 5 years after they completed, which brings us up to 2012 or 2013.
All right. Thank you.
So a few key takeaways. I'm maybe being intentionally provocative here. Cost is not equal to tuition. High cost is not equal unaffordable. Look, high cost is a problem. There's no question about that. But it is not as simple. It does not equate to unaffordability, given the other dimensions to this issue that I've described, including the potential that higher education, even at high cost, can be a very good investment for a student who succeeds, particularly in degrees where that or certificates where that earnings power is quite strong. So we would encourage the commission as it engages around, or the committee as it engages around this topic, to think beyond just tuition. Think aid, both state, institutional, other forms of financial aid. Think about completion. Really, there's the distinguishing characteristic between a high cost experience that is worthwhile and one that is not. The most salient feature is whether or not that student completed and earned a degree. Time to completion, the type of degree, certificate, or major, and of course, earnings. I've got a couple of more slides. I'm not going to put them up. If you were presented with the presentation, or if you have it, or if it's on OLIS, I think it includes a couple more slides related to student debt. And I, just because there's been so much attention to this, the only note there is that debt, very high levels of debt that garner headlines, are especially related to graduate programs. Right? That's where we find these sort of $100,000-plus dollar debts, not exclusively, but almost exclusively, are related to graduate education. And of course, you know, if you're getting if you're getting medical training, right, that's sort of what you would expect. I'm not saying that's a good thing, but that's a very different type of issue for somebody who's walking away entering the medical field than it is for somebody who is walking away from a couple of years of undergraduate education without a degree. I'm going to have Bob talk about the Oregon Opportunity Grant briefly, and let's see if there are any questions.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So good morning. Again, my name is Bob Brew. I'm the director of the Office of Student Access and Completion. We do several things. We're actually located in Eugene, and we run the state's need-based grant program, the Oregon Opportunity Grant, in addition to administering private scholarships and Aspire mentoring programs and several other state and federal grant programs. The Oregon Opportunity Grant is Oregon's only need-based grant program. We have an appropriation of about $115 million a biennium. We serve roughly 70,000 students per biennium. Currently, our maximum grant for a full-time student taking 12 credits is $2,000. We do half-time awards for students that are taking at least 6 credits a term. About 10% of our students are in private nonprofit schools. I believe about 50% are in community colleges, about 40% are in the four-year universities. We've been doing this program since 1959. To qualify for a grant, you have to be attending a public college or university, or not-for-profit private university based in Oregon. It's A student can achieve the opportunity grant for up to 4 years of full-time study, up to 8 years of half-time study. And I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have about that.
Thank you. Representative McKeown.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Bob, welcome to our committee. This is very, very interesting and important information for all of us. With full disclosure, I worked at the Oregon Student Assistance Commission for about 8 years, and I worked in a program that provided opportunities to train volunteers and high school staff on how students become good consumers. So I'm very familiar with the program. But during the opportunity grant years when I was there, the threshold for income changed as the funds waxed and waned, and there was more constraint or less constraint on the system as students were applying. Could you just kind of characterize now what that income range is for students that are applying for the opportunity grant now? I know the total cost has gone up, and the grant award has gone up, to around $2,000. But what's the family income level where kids qualify?
Sure. Representative Reed, Representative McKeown. So the opportunity grant went through a major redesign in 2007. Prior to that, it was really tied closely to the federal Pell Grant, where basically the neediest of the needy students would qualify. In 2007, I believe, was the first year of the shared responsibility model, which was designed to create the economy was better. There were more monies in the coffer. The program was expanded to help more middle-income kids. A brilliant program. Just the timing was not perfect, and we ran into the recession. And coming out of into the recession, then we had a whole bunch of folks that were out of work and a variety of other issues going on. And so we ended up getting many more people that qualified under the formula for the opportunity grant than we had funds. So currently we serve about 20% of the students that would, at least by our formula, qualify for the opportunity grant. I don't know if that answered your question.
I think, time gone by, we got up to a point where we were actually serving those middle-income families where the total family income was around $60,000, $70,000. They were getting a partial grant. We were trying to get that community college pipeline full. Are we still up in that range, or have we had to drop that down because of constraints in the system?
Yes, thank you. So the shared responsibility model does specify a top income range of $70,000, and that's what's still in statute right now. So basically, among the 150,000 students that are qualified, we've had to just say, if you meet this $70,000 threshold and other criteria, it's basically first come, first serve.
Okay, and follow up. Yeah. That was going to be my next question. There was a point in time where the goal was to serve all students that qualified, and more money was put in the system, hopefully, to accomplish that. Then the economy seriously got in the way, and the whole system was constrained. More people coming in, less money to serve. So are there limits now? Are there deadlines? Is it first come, first serve? How's it working now as far as the pipeline piece?
So right now it is a first come, first serve. We have a soft deadline of February 1st that just happens to be when we typically run out of money. And students have really adapted. We get many more applications in January than we previously did before this was instituted. There is a design a work group that's working on how can we tweak this a little bit to make sure that we're meeting the needs of our neediest students first and being able to make that deadline a little more flexible.
And one more follow-up. Are you still kind of tiering that system? They're partial Pell or partial opportunity grants. Kids can be fully qualified or they can have partial awards. Is that still the case?
So right now we have a flat grant amount of $2,000. So for a student that's taking 12 or more credits, and a flat grant amount of $1,000 that's for a student that's taking between 6 and 12 credits.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Representative Hayden, then we'll come to Representative Reardon.
Thank you, Chair Reardon. I have a question on your cost-benefit analysis for education. One thing that seems to be missing to me is job satisfaction. I'm not sure how you could quantitate that, but an example is maybe somebody, a lawyer, physician, surgeon, goes and gets their education. They look, it costs me that much, and my earnings are X. Well, you compare that to a vet, that's going to go out and do basically the same thing as a surgeon, but on animals. But their income, I would guess, and I don't have the numbers, is probably significantly lower than the ones that work on humans. But when you talk to these veterinarians, they say, I love doing what I'm doing. So for them in that industry, there's a benefit for going into the industry. And I think of that in terms of public health also. There's people that want to go into public health because that's what they want to do. And I don't see in the cost-benefit analysis. I'm not sure how you could do it, but it would be interesting to me, is there a job satisfaction that goes along? So maybe there is more success in some of these areas than it looks where it comes up on the formula as unaffordable, but it's unaffordable because they're gaining something else other than dollars.
Representative Hayden, Representative Reed, I think that's a terrific question. An analysis that looks only at cost-benefit in terms of in financial terms is insufficient. And that's all that we've provided here. I don't know whether that type, or sort of exactly where to go for that type of analysis. I would, however, it does bring to mind work that Gallup, the polling firm, has done over several years on well-being, and well-being is expressed in partly in terms of job satisfaction, and they've been looking very specifically at relationship with higher education experiences, and be happy to share that sort of summary of that work, because they've it has permitted them to sort of describe what attributes of higher education appear to contribute to job well-being, not understood in earnings terms, but in feeling meaningfully engaged in one's work and other attributes that they've sort of long known track really well with sort of personal well-being. And so it's fascinating work. Has a lot. It says a lot about the importance of mentors. It says a lot about the importance of sort of projects at work. And it may say something about degree fields and other attributes of higher education.
Thank you for making the point. I had the same criticism when I was in business school, that it's not just that you had a job at graduation. It was it the right job? So yeah. I appreciate the point very much. Representative Reardon?
Back in the day, I was able to work part-time and got the GI Bill and completed college in 3 years. So it was pretty affordable. If I'm a veteran today, can I do something similar to that? Or how affordable is college for veterans?
Representative Reardon, Chair Reed, I would want to get back to you with a more detailed answer than I would say now, which is that veterans experience many of the same challenges associated with higher education affordability as the general population, notwithstanding some of the benefits that they may have accrued as a result of their service. So I don't believe that the situation is fundamentally altered for veterans, unfortunately, that our veterans' benefits, while important and significant, have left veterans, too, with facing many of the same affordability challenges that that our general population does. But I'd be happy to get back to you.
I really appreciate
with more
that.
Details.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Representative Gallegos.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Hayden, it's interesting, your point. I think that, and I don't have the reference to this, but I believe I heard at some point that particularly teachers have a 50% dropout rate after about 5 years of teaching. And as for me anyway, trying to think about workforce development, thinking beyond graduation and the costs and so on, but how do we really think about and get data with regard to that kind of what happens after we graduate, after we get into the workforce. And it seems that's an important gray area that we need to think about.
Representative Gallegos, Representative Reed, I agree. Good point. I think it does highlight the need to look more past just the first year, whether or not someone got a job or their first year earnings, 5 years or better, and earnings themselves is insufficient. The only other thing I'll add on that is that one of the challenges is, if you really drive down on this economic data, one of the problems that we've got around affordability related to earnings is that while college remains a good investment for those who get the degree, particularly in certain fields, their earnings dividends, that we've experienced cost increases, and earnings for most of this population have been stagnant or declining in real dollars for the last decade, and it's the first decade and half a century where that's been the case. So that's really, I think, a big part of the reason why, even when you take this more complex view of affordability, families and students are looking at it today and wondering, gosh, does this make sense? Earnings have been flat or declining in real terms, and that's not, maybe that's outside of the purview of the higher education system itself, perhaps not this committee.
Yeah, it's a larger economic issue to some degree, for sure. Representative Nierman, and then Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Cannon, you know, I appreciate the complexity of the cost and the affordability thing, and your point that it's not, you know, tuition doesn't equal cost, kind of thing like that. I'm looking at your graph on the earning trends by major, and it's kind of an eye chart of a graph, and that's not really a criticism because I don't think there's a real good way to put the data up there and not make it an eye chart. But to me, it looks like this is kind of something that could be an important component of affordability here, where you have differences that are, you know, up to 200% based on major, you know, the earnings ability there. And so you have a real opportunity there. It's been my experience, too, in the workforce that I work in, that we've had a hard time finding people in some of those things that pay higher, all that. And I'm reluctant to suggest that you restrict certain majors, basket weaving or whatever, something like that. But at the very least, maybe we can reconsider what we subsidize and what kind of bang we get for the buck for that, and what society gets, and, you know, what the workforce gets for some of those kinds of things. Is there any thought about that?
Representative Nierman, Chair Reed, there has been a lot of thought about it, and I think that the interest that this legislature has shown, at least as reflected in bill introductions and conversations about investments and really intentional work around STEM and CTE, for example, reflects in part, I think, this kind of data. At the commission level, one of the ways in which we're taking this data into account is in our work on potential changes to how the state allocates the dollars that you appropriate for colleges and universities, weighting or providing extra weight in that funding allocation to certain degrees that appear more closely linked with higher earnings, thereby providing a greater incentive, we believe, for the institution to really focus on student success in those areas. So, you know, we'd be happy to come back and describe to you the ways in which we're proposing to do that through the funding allocation model. That alone is a sort of incomplete strategy because especially when it's STEM and CTE. I mean, I fundamentally believe that a lot of this goes back to K-12, back to math education, back to project-based learning, back to, you know, it's not just a higher education problem, but clearly we do have some tools, some mechanisms we can use in higher education as a state to help promote work and success and graduates in these areas.
Representative Johnson, then we'll come to Representative McKinnon,
thank you,
and then
Mr. Chair.
If it's okay with everybody, I want to try to move on. We've got some other great presenters, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ben and or Bob, related to that same question, what conversations has the HEC had regarding weighting the opportunity grant to try to create incentives for students to choose those more satisfying careers or those careers where they're most likely to have the opportunity to actually pay back the debt when they're complete?
I'll take a shot, and then Bob may have something to add. Representative Johnson, Chair Reed, we have had the conversation. So we're in our sort of second iteration of there was a work group sort of officially chartered by the HAG, led by a commissioner, involvement from a lot of institutions and other stakeholders that spent months coming up with principles for potential revisions to the opportunity grant. We now have a design team that's mostly financial aid professionals from the campuses working with Bob on taking those principles and turning them into something that would be actionable and by you. And we've introduced a bill. We're working on amendments to that bill. Those proposals do not currently include a weighting or a focus on particular degrees and majors. However, it was discussed. I'll I'll say one of the challenges associated that with on a practical side is really even the identification of students who would be eligible. Mm-hmm. You know, a student doesn't always come to Oregon State and in their first year say, I'm a STEM degree. I mean, many do, don't get me wrong, but so how you would figure out who those students are before they've graduated, but when they need their financial aid is, I think, one of the practical challenges. I would also be remiss if I didn't say there were plenty of folks participating in this process who had sort of philosophical challenges with that approach as well.
So, Representative Reed, Representative Johnson, thanks. So I was trained as an economist, so I can see, obviously, on the one hand, on the other hand, right? So what someone would say, perhaps one of my professors would say, is, you know, a degree in teaching costs basically the same as a degree in engineering, but the outcomes are very different. So someone might say, we should charge more for a degree in engineering than we do for a teaching degree if we want them to have similar affordability. On the other hand, the reason wages are so much higher in some STEM fields is because we have a shortage. And so maybe it does make sense to subsidize them at a greater level than in other areas where we have a surplus. I think we're having this discussion. It's clearly a philosophical discussion, and I know that we're having these discussions at the redesign group and in other places. So.
Great. Thank you. Representative McHugh.
Thank you, Chair Reed. That's fascinating. If you could tie that thread to what are the obvious workforce needs, as opposed to even the potential earnings. That's an interesting thought. I hadn't thought of that. I want to take this back one step further and hearken back to a comment that was made in our first meeting at the University of Georgia, I believe, or Georgia State, where 40 people can have a significant impact one-on-one with students. And one thing that we're missing here is how we or the potential we have to, or how we now work with students who are coming through the pipeline in high school to educate them about the things that we are talking about right here at this moment. Because when you're 16, 17 years old, you're clueless about this. You're not thinking in that direction because you don't know what you don't know. And whether it's training high school counselors, people who are working high school counseling offices who are constrained when budgets are cut, those are the first people that go. How do you provide that support for those students on training them to be thinking not only just about what they want to do when they're in college, which they do, and a lot of it has to do with what's going on Saturday night and how are they going to get around, and they're nervous about their dorm roommate, or they're navigating uncharted waters, and it's very complex. But how do we provide that support for them so that they're thinking about these things that we're talking about, which is, can I afford it? How am I going to get paid if I go into X field? Because a lot of this is information they don't have unless there's some sort of a port system there to make sure that they understand it, and either at the high school level or at the college level. And it really intrigued me when we had the conversation the other day, because that's what it takes. It's that one-on-one with the kid saying the support that you need to make sure that they're very well educated about what their options are and what the ramifications of those decisions are.
Representative McHugh and Chair Reed, I don't have much to add to that other than to say yes, agree, and Aspire clearly reflects for the state our most significant direct investment in that type of approach. But it is a very, very modest investment that touches, you know, a small percent of, actually significant, but small percent of students who need that type of coaching and counseling in middle and high school. I think that it'd be a good question to ask the institutions as well, hearing the Georgia State example and knowing that Oregon institutions also have examples of ways in which their work with students at intake around financial literacy, around questions of borrowing and major and, you know, is having a real positive effect, but needs support. Mm-hmm. And just agree wholeheartedly with the point.
Thank you. Representative Reardon?
I can't help it. I have to make a quick comment. I mean, I really think so much of what we're talking about this morning really does start at, as Mr. Cannon suggested earlier, you know, in K-12 at a minimum 7th grade, and start having more career awareness experiences and understanding at that point, because that's where they're curious. They really want to know. And So we'll be having more discussions about CTE and how that relates to the whole workforce question. But the other comment or observation is that I think so many of our counselors and teachers and administrators lack real-world work experience. Just they went to high school and went to college and maybe went right into teaching and administration. And so we need to work a little bit on helping those counselors get that experience. Those administrators understand what's going on in the real world, too. So, those are things I think will really help set up a better situation for kids so they get the information early to make the kind of decisions that we're talking about this morning. So,
thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate you being here. We're excited to have some folks from individual institutions. Chris Maples, president of Oregon Institute of Technology, OIT, and Saba Randhawa. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Dr. Randhawa, we appreciate you being here, too. If you gentlemen would like to join us, we're eager to hear from you.
I work in all the high schools in Klamath Falls.
It looks like you've had some conversation about who's going to lead us off, so we'll be glad to let you proceed.
Good morning.
You can go first.
All right.
Up to you.
We each have
things that we're covering. So.
Great.
Thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Sabat Ndawa. I serve as the Provost and Executive Vice President for Oregon State University. What I want to do is to share with you some perspectives on a framework for performance and mission fulfillment and impact of funding on performance within that particular framework. In response to a request from Chair Reed, we prepared and submitted information on a number of metrics associated with our performance. Please let us know if you need clarification or additional information, but I would really would focus more on the performance framework rather than on specific numbers. So there are, if you look at our performance and mission fulfillment, there are essentially three essential and overlapping components for each of our universities. Accreditation establishes the baseline metrics for meeting our mission. And as you all know, accreditation is really critical to each of our institutions in terms of, it's the process of recognizing performance, quality, institutional integrity, and really entitles institutions in terms of confidence with educational community, with the state and federal government, and with the public. So really the accreditation established baseline metrics. Strategic plan or strategic priorities at each of our institutions allows us to focus on areas of excellence, on the impact that we have on Oregon, on the region, and beyond. And then the achievement compacts with the state establishes our commitment of each of our institutions with 40-40-20 and with state's educational goals. And so if you look at this framework, achievement compacts, the strategic priorities of each institution, and then the broader accreditation requirements, that sort of establishes, if you would, the ecosystem of goals and metrics that we are looking at. To give you a little bit of sense of some of the metrics that we track in terms of performance, let me start off with achievement compacts first, where the focus is one on completion of degrees, and this is degrees granted to Oregonians, to different student populations within that, for example, rural Oregonians or first-generation students and so on. It focuses on quality, and to Representative Hayden's earlier comment or observation, one of the ways that we have been looking at it is trying to assess alumni satisfaction. And these are folks who are out of college for 3 to 5 years. They have a sense of what education has brought to them. And so, how do they perceive the value of education in terms of where they are and in terms of their advancement in their careers. And connections essentially refers to bachelor's degree that are granted to students from Oregon community colleges that transfer into our universities. And so that's the pipeline between community colleges and our four-year universities. The strategic plan goals then essentially for Oregon State University, and I think that's true for each of the institutions, but I can talk more specifically about OSU, certainly includes the achievement compact metrics and goals, but it also includes goals and metrics that are associated with parts of our mission related to research and scholarship and to outreach and engagement. And so, for example, in terms of research and scholarship, it includes research funding, our performance on various innovation activities, for example, patents, invention disclosures, our contribution to industry, PhD degrees granted because they directly relate to the to research growth, and to in terms of outreach and engagement, things like online enrollment, the reach of our extension services. Many of you know that's a critical component of Oregon State University, alumni engagement and fundraising. And so there are a number of other dimensions beyond the achievement compacts that are part of our strategic planning goals. And then finally, when we get to accreditation, it encompasses a lot of those goals, but it also places a significant component on assessment that perhaps is required by our accreditation agencies. And that is assessment of academic programs, assessment of outcome, learning outcomes, assessment of student experience, significant focus on community-based and high-impact learning and how do we measure and assess that, that was talked about in the earlier conversation, and student performance on national licensing exams required in most professional disciplines, engineering, education, business, pharmacy, vet med, and so on. So this essentially gives you a framework in terms of the ecosystem of goals that we have and the ecosystem of metrics in terms of how we gauge and measure performance over time. Now, one of the things as we measure performance is that from year to year, it's at times hard to gauge performance. And I'm not going to talk about all the metrics, but let me, you know, one way to look at it is to look at perhaps snapshots at different points in time. And so what I wanted to give you is a little bit of picture of for Oregon State University. And I've picked 2007, 8, and 13, 14 in part because they coincide with the planning cycles at the university. Our strategic plan was reviewed every 5 years. We do a fairly intensive review every year in terms of how we are doing on key metrics. But in particular, every 5 years, we really go in and dig and compare with our peers in terms of where we are and what is going on. Coincidentally, 7-8 also coincides with the major recession here in the state as well as globally, and so it gives you a sense of what's going on. Again, really, without really getting into numbers, it gives you a sense that over this 6-7 year period, we have grown both in terms of input metrics like enrollments, as well as in some of the output metrics like degrees granted, research, by a tune of over 40% in most of those metrics. So there has been a significant growth in the university and significant growth in the system as a whole. This is a reflective of the broader seven university system. And this has happened at a time when there has been significant challenges with state appropriations, state funding, with federal funding, both in competitive grants as well as in formula funding for extension, ag experiment station, and forest research lab. So the university has done remarkably well in terms of growing and expanding at a time when we have had significant economic challenges.
Two questions on your slide. Sorry to interrupt.
Absolutely.
One is, I don't know SWPS, if you can, statewide, I don't remember the PS, if you help me on that.
Representative Reed, statewide public service programs is basically Extension Service,
okay.
Ag Experiment Station, and Forest Research Lab taken together. We call them statewide public service programs.
The second one, annual campaign commitments. I'm sorry I don't remember the exact timing of the campaign, which I understand is essentially complete now. Is it reasonable to think of that as sort of a measure of fundraising success rather than unique to the campaign that was ongoing at those two points?
Representative Reed, you're right. I mean, so it is a success of the campaign. And, you know, one of the things that I do want to make here is that, and I'll get to this later on too, that state funding, the education in general funding, state funding and tuition taken together is absolutely critical and really is the main source of running our institution in terms of the core education enterprise and in terms of the administrative infrastructure that is needed. But really the margin of excellence, those ENG does not provide funding for developing, really taking the institution to the next level. So really the margin of excellence comes from research funding and from private philanthropy. And so you're absolutely right, Chair Reed, that it is a reflection of a decade of work. And really the expectation is that our annual annual philanthropy actually would double at the end of the campaign and stay at that level or higher than it was at the start of the campaign.
Right. So it's not just that campaign.
It's
an indication of philanthropy as a whole.
It's a continuous indication, absolutely.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. The other thing that I wanted to point out is that, each of our institution benchmark our metrics and our performance against aspirational peers. And part of the reason for doing that is to gauge our outcomes in terms of how we are doing with other, high-performing institutions, but also to identify some of the best practices they are using, whether it's around student success, around philanthropy, around research. For OSU, we have 10 land grants, 10 or 11 land grants that we use for our benchmarking performance, and they are institutions like Cornell, UC Davis, Michigan State, Purdue, Texas A&M, University of Arizona. So they're institutions that in many dimensions are really doing a great work. The challenge we have is that most of those institutions are 2 to 4 times the size of Oregon State University, in part because they are in states that are heavily populated. And most of them, for example, have medical schools. And, state of Oregon only, as you all know, has only one medical school. So what we do is essentially try to benchmark normalized metrics. And so what we try to do is to reduce our metrics on a per capita basis, whether it's based on state dollars or based on enrollment. And again, what I want to share with you is just a snapshot of how we have done over the past 8 years relative to ourselves and relative to our peers. Now, there's a lot of information on this chart, but just stepping back and looking at the picture itself without the numbers, and I can share the numbers with you, really, the green graph, spider graph, is essentially where OSU was in 2007-2008 when we completed phase two of our strategic plan. The orange is where we are today, now that we are starting the next phase of our strategic plan. And the blue represents the average of our aspirational peers on those metrics.
We want to move to the outside, correct?
We would like to move to be outside on all of that, exactly.
Okay.
And so as you could see that on some metric, so first of all, we have made significant progress pretty much in all the metrics. And I've picked 8 of the metrics here. 4 of them are related with education, 3 of them with research, and there is philanthropy since it has been such a critical part of the institution over the past decade. We outperform now our peers on some areas. So, for example, on degrees per dollar invested by the state, we are doing phenomenally better than many of our peers, and certainly compared to where we were. Similarly, on some of the innovation activities, licensing revenue using as a metric, we are outperforming our peers. We are close in some other metrics. So, for example, degrees per 1,000 enrollment, we have made significant progress. Again, the denominator here is the input. The degrees granted are the outcome from the institution. We do need to make progress in some other areas. And so, for example, on first-year retention rate, and the reason I've picked first-year retention rate here rather than six-year graduation rate is because six-year graduation rate is a lag indicator. It takes a long time before it is impacted. It's relatively easier to see the trend in the first-year retention rate. In 7-8, we were at about 80%. Today or last year, we were at about 84.5%. Our peers are closer to 90%. So, you know, made progress, but we still need to get to a point where we are not losing students, because the attrition in the first year then certainly impacts what happens 6 or 4 years later on. The one area where we were really underperforming was in our relationship, particularly regarding research with industry. When we started in 2006-07, only about 1.5% of our research portfolio came from industry funding. Most of it was competitive federal grants. We have made progress. We are now closer to 3% over the past 5-6 years. We've really put in a focused effort in expanding that activity. Our peers are closer to 5.5 to 6% of our total portfolio comes from industry. So we still have some work to do in terms of increasing our relationship with industry. And I think that's also important because federal funding is relatively stagnant for competitive research grants.
Interrupt for just a second. Representative Wisner has questions.
Yeah, real quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Provost, first-year retention rates, that's amazing that you're saying it's 80 and 90%. I'm old enough to remember it used to be two-thirds, especially at state schools. Your MITs and Stanford, I expect 80, 90, higher than 90. Is that a significant change in academia?
Representative Visnet, Chair Reed, you are right. That is a significant change. And part of it is that a lot of the land grants we are comparing ourselves to, where the blue thing comes in, also become more selective. So, even if you look at Purdue, for example, they have become a lot more selective in terms of the incoming students that they take. Look at Michigan State. They have a network of branch campuses. And so basically the main campus against which we are comparing ourselves are taking students, you know, at the higher end of the profile in terms of performance.
So that's
certainly, you're absolutely right. That is reflective in terms of the 89 or 90% first-year retention rate.
Thank you.
And just for comparison, there are 6 years. Your graduation rate is somewhere between 70 to 75% of these institutions.
While we've interrupted you, and at the risk of asking a question you're about to answer, even if I didn't ask it, how did these, it sounded like you've selected some indicators to present here. It's a very interesting way of doing it. Can you tell me whether that's true, and what other kinds of things are amongst the things you track?
Representative Reed, thank you for the question. As I was sharing earlier, we track somewhere between 2 dozen to 3 dozen indicators. Again, looking at accreditation, university goals, and the achievement compacts. But I would say that of those, about a dozen of them are where we really pay attention, because if you as you all know, you need to cut through the noise and get to the small set of indicators that really reflect institutional performance. So beyond the ones that are reflected here, what we track are some indicators around enrollments. And this is not just the total enrollment, but also enrollment, the diversity of enrollment in terms of underrepresented populations, international, non-residents, so on. We track some indicators that are related to the statewide public service program, since they are such a critical component of Oregon State University. The reason I don't have them here is because they are a lot harder to compare with peers. So there are not too many institutions that have forestry programs, funding for forest research labs, so it becomes very difficult to provide a comparison across institutions. And then, as I said, you know, we track some additional measures related with our research and innovation enterprise in terms of licensing new companies, patents, and things of that nature. And so about a dozen indicators that are really critical to the institution.
Thank you. That's helpful.
The one indicator, the last one I wanted to point out here is that where we, you know, if you look at the graphs here, it shows we have made really no progress, is around this undergraduate to graduate ratio. And that is used more as a metric for the size of the graduate enterprise, primarily because it is linked to the research. You know, faculty rely a lot on graduate students in terms of doing research and so on. It's not because our graduate students haven't increased. In fact, they've increased at about 10% over the past 2 or 3 years in particular. Undergraduates have increased at a disproportionate rate, and so the overall numbers, you know, still have essentially remained the same from that perspective. But again, you know, it does point out to the fact that perhaps there is a need of some targeted graduate programs that are linked to areas where there is a lot of innovation activities that we need to further push than we have in the past.
This is just very brief. What is the number you aspire to in your undergraduate-graduate ratio?
Representative McEwen, Chair Reed, currently our mix is about 82-18. 82 undergraduate and about 18. And so what we have really tried to get to without really impacting the undergraduate in terms of aspiration is about 3/4 and 1/4, you know, 75-25. Most of our aspirational peers are more like 2/3, 1/3 type, 67% to 70% range undergraduate.
Thank you.
So again, I wanted to give you a snapshot of tracking, you know, how we track and how we compare and how we benchmark over time our indicators. You know, again, one of the things says without saying, and I think Mr. Cannon's presentation talked about it, is that, you know, increased funding certainly can go a long ways in terms of impacting some of these metrics. And the next two slides, sort of to finish off my presentation, is some information taken from Portland State and from the University of Oregon in terms of, but also point out some of the challenges that we have been having at all our institutions. As I said before, all our institutions, we are all serving a much larger student body. We are focused more intentionally on research and economic development activities. But as this slide from PSU points out, that, you know, cuts in state funding has had an impact on how effectively we can move some of these metrics, and the impact is different at each of our institutions. At PSU in particular, to point out that the two biggest impact really has been is in spending the reserves or our fund balances to backfill and to defer replacement of tenure-track faculty with non-tenure-track faculty. Again, there have been impact in the classroom, students taking longer because access to key courses perhaps is not there. And support for some of the activities that are really needed around student success in high-impact practices, counseling, and so on have been impacted to different degrees, I think, to many of our institutions. I think this is a good sort of a closing and a summary slide. As I said earlier, education and general fund, both state support as well as tuition, is the main source of financial support for our operations. Certainly, the state support has been decreasing, with the slack being picked up by tuition, as was pointed out in the earlier presentation. And the number varies. You know, for UFO, it's 6% of the total budget. For OSU, it's about 10.5%. PSU, it's about 12.5%. But again, for the ENG budget for OSU, it's about 20.9% of the support is education and general funds. So just depending on what is the denominator we are using here. But I think the other key thing is that there are two areas that we really believe that we can enhance significantly with increased support from the state. And the two areas really come down to scaling and to capacity. I think we are all trying experiments that in a small domain have been working wonders. I've listed a couple of them here from the University of Oregon, Pathway Oregon, and the Graduate Assistant Grant, focused on increasing access in the first 2 years and then ensuring that students in the upper division get to graduate. I think each of our institutions have programs that are very similar to that. The issue is trying to scale them from a small student population to student body of 20,000 or 15,000. And so increased funding can really help in helping scale those elements. And the other thing is increasing capacity, both in terms of faculty as well as in terms of critical support that is needed for support services. In high-impact practices, in counseling, in advising, and things of that nature. And so to summarize, and I'd be glad to answer questions, is I wanted to give a sense of how we operationalize our mission fulfillment around these ecosystem of metrics and these three elements, how we benchmark and assess progress, and tie that increased funding request from the state and from the legislature connected to increasing capacity and in increasing the scale of what we are doing in terms of best practices. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Rondeau. We appreciate it.
Great presentation.
Mr. President. Representative Hayden, do you have a quick question? Sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Just a quick question or maybe a comment here. A couple of things, and this kind of goes back to Mr. Cannon's presentation yesterday, but congratulations on the success that you're having with your program. I'm interested in finding out a little more information about what we're kind of looking at from the aspect of not being successful are the ones that don't graduate. Where do they go? I'd like to know, for example, I went to your school and I was one of your first-year dropouts, if you will. So I went cherry-picked some classes that I went to school there at Oregon State. And then went on to higher education and got my graduate degree. But it wasn't that I wanted to be part of it. It wasn't that I didn't want a four-year degree. It's just that I picked up some classes that were important to me at the time, and I moved on. My question is there a way for you to capture the information of what happens to the percentage of population that doesn't graduate? Are those our policemen? Are those our firefighters? Are those our aviators? There's success in those, so I think there might be some success in what we're looking at is not necessarily success. And so I think that goes back to Mr. Cannon's presentation yesterday, where I asked about how do we capture what might be successes that we're not thinking of. Just the other second one, and this is not a editorial, it's just a question. I noticed you mentioned that there's one medical school in Oregon. Is the DO school in Lebanon for higher education not considered a medical school, or does that fall under medical school?
Chair Reed, Representative Hayden, a couple of observations on your first question or comment. Actually, President Maples and I were just talking about it earlier today. We have not, the fact is in the past, institutions have not done a very good job of tracking where the students who drop out from the university go. But I think there are a couple of observations I want to make. One, there is now a national clearinghouse database that has been set up, not just for Oregon institutions, but national database. And I think that will help us track better in terms of where the students are going, not just in terms of alternative jobs that they are taking if they, for example, drop out from a four-year universities. But there are many students who still graduate from a four-year university, except that it is not in Oregon. So they may leave Oregon State because, for example, we have limited capacity in our engineering programs. We only take a certain number of students, and so many of them, for example, may go to Washington State University or University of Idaho. And so one of the things we are trying to do is that 60.5% number that Mr. Cannon showed earlier, the six-year graduation rate, it's not 90% if you track those students, but I think it's certainly higher than 60% if you start tracking students who go to a non-Oregon four-year institution. But again, the other thing, as you point out, are students that that do get meaningful employment even without a four-year degree, and we haven't done it. The other thing that I wanted to share in that from that regard is that the biggest growth at OSU over the past 3 to 5 years has been in an online program. So many students are taking much longer to finish, and they are doing it using online education. It has increased by about 20% per year over the past 3 years. Right now, we offer 37 degrees that are totally online. And this fall, our enrollment was 4,500. So about 15% of the total enrollment is in online education. So that's also skewing the data in terms of the graduation rate and how long some of those students are taking to complete. To your second question, you're absolutely right. We do have a new medical school. Typically, and maybe it's just unconscious or inadvertent, okay, that we talk about OSU primarily because it's a research institution and still the major research medical institution, but you're right. There is a second medical school in Lebanon.
Real quick.
Very quickly, please.
I'm watching the clock.
Yes, I am.
Could you just a little, I'm concerned about the impact of the amount of remedial education you have to give when students come in. I understand that's quite significant. Any comments or strategies around this?
Well, I'll try to be good. Thanks, Representative.
Question Reardon. Was quick, maybe not the answer.
Chair Reed, it does have a significant impact, and actually, we are using online education quite a bit now for remedial education. For preparatory math courses, for example, they have to take. We have, particularly with Lynn Benton Community College, we have an arrangement in terms of them offering more courses in Math 65 and 95, and so on and so forth. But it does have a significant impact, and it does impact the retention graduate, or at least the time to graduation, let me put it this way, because we are getting students with very different back. Even a 3.5 GPA from different high schools mean very different thing when it comes to academic preparation. And so one of the challenges is how do we get to a consistent basis.
Thank you. And Representative Wisnett, you had a comment?
Yeah, yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for committee members. The slide three, we talked about enrollment degrees, and I'd just like to bring to attention OSU Cascade. We'll probably hear more about that, but Oregon State's been a big supporter of this. And the reason they've supported it is because they have a geographic capacity that they've reached, and it fits into the 40-40-20 goals. So I'm sure we'll hear more about that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I am too. Thank you.
Thank
Mr.
you.
President.
Chair Reed. Vice Chair Gallegos and Wisnett, and members of the committee. For the record, Chris Maples, President of the Oregon Institute of Technology, a.k.a. Oregon Tech. I've been asked to represent the true universities, the technical and regional universities here. We are going through a period this year of intense change. Our new boards are coming on board. We have the current Board of Higher Education phasing out. We have a Chancellor's Office phasing out. And so we are basically knee-deep in all of those changes and challenges as we go through. And if I hit tab. Perfect.
Once I set it up.
Got it. Does that be for slideshow here? Aha. So what you're going to hear is a consistent theme from us, but I think it represents a lot of what the seven universities collectively are facing, and that is the student cost pressures. And I'm using cost in much the same way as was excellently described by Executive Director Cannon earlier today. Student support for graduate success and the system changes and the altered financial picture that is associated with those system changes, particularly for the smaller universities. Frankly, the decrease in state support has been one of the major cost drivers in terms of cost pressures for students. I would extend kudos to both the governor and the legislature for increase in the Oregon Opportunity Grant amount and for a recognition that that there has to be need-based aid. But I would tell you that much more needs to be done on need-based aid. We have a tremendous number of Pell-eligible, that is, need-based students in the rural and smaller universities. For Oregon Tech, it's about 70% of our students. To give you a feeling for where that sits nationally, a year and a half ago, I was at a White House event in which a number of university presidents were talking about the major changes that they were doing. And a president of an Eastern private university was receiving major, major recognition for increasing the number of Pell-eligible students from 7 to 12%. We're around 70, and we're not unusual for the smaller schools. And I would also point out that really for the first time in our history, the number of students who are college-age students is now more than 50% Pell-eligible nationwide. So we have this disparity of student affordability going to college, and different approaches by students doing this. And this is where I'm wandering off script a bit. I'm a walk-around manager. I walk around, I talk to students, I talk to everybody, and I listen. So I'm going to give you two stories, both involving dental hygiene programs that we have in the state. One here in Salem at Chemeketa Community College in a partnership with Chemeketa. Students start at Chemeketa, transfer to us, but they stay here. Our faculty are here. They stay on the site at Chemeketa. I asked them all. I asked the sophomore class, okay, why'd you pick us? They were nice enough to say the reputation, and we have a good reputation. We have a great pass rate for national exams. All but two in that sophomore class said that they picked Chemeketa because they could stay here, they could live at home, they could keep the part-time jobs they had, they could keep costs down for them as a broad definition of cost. Contrast that with the dental hygiene program that we have in LeGrand, a private partnership, a private-public partnership with both Eastern Oregon University and now MOTA, the former ODS, where the dental hygiene students there earn an associate's degree in about 16 months, less than 2 years. They pay more in that 16 months than they would pay in 2 years. But they almost everyone said that that was okay because it was a short time to degree. They got out. They were going to have to borrow money for a certain period of time. They were done borrowing that money, and they could go on and start working and paying that back. So they were actually willing to pay a premium for a high-quality course that got them done and got them on their way. Two very different approaches, two very different student clientels. But it's a good representation of where student of a couple of places where student cost pressures are going to continue to be a critical component that we collectively address lots of different ways. We do this also by working with high schools, community colleges for dual enrollment, seamless transfers, and dual credits. And I would also point out that in a general sense, going back to Executive Director Cannon's slide about the different students and whether or not there was good or bad outcome, as a general rule of thumb, if your student debt is less than your first-year gross income, it was a reasonable investment. And that's been sort of the higher ed kind of approach to this for some period of time.
Sure, I got this. There we go.
Pell-eligible students really do require more student support, and therefore more professional staff to help them get through the universities. The question came about the preparation of students coming in and some of the things that we do. I can tell you that one of the things that we do at Oregon Tech is that the student tuition and fees includes free for all students peer support, peer mentoring. It used to be called tutoring, but it's basically students that we pay minimum wage, but we pay, who have taken classes, who can then teach other students in our Student Success Center. And that's for every single class we have. Now, I admit it's tougher in higher level classes because it's harder to find students who have gone through those classes to do the teaching, but that's part of the success of trying to mentor students through and try to get them through and make sure that they graduate. Because, again, as Executive Director Cannon pointed out, I think in the examples that he showed, the worst things we could do is have students get in, not get a degree, and have the debt. And you would see that that's the common denominator in whether or not the price of education, the cost of education, was worth it for many students. The true universities have extremely lean staffs, extremely lean. In 2008-2009, we cut approximately $2 million out of our operating expenses in a single biennium, primarily out of administrative cuts and in some degree of student support cuts. And I had to make at that time the absolutely, I will tell you, gut-wrenching decision to cut outreach toward high schools and at-risk students and focus our resources on the students who were with us because we brought them in and we owed it to them to get them through. And given that Sophie's choice, that was where we had to go. And I would tell you that the truths operate on such small margins that these are the kinds of decisions that we have been facing on a regular basis for the past 6-7 years. I started here in October 2008. And when I tell people that who are in economics, they start laughing mostly because it has been an amazing ride in our economy for that period of time that I have been here. I will tell you that there is much excitement about our new boards, about the boards coming on, about having a group of people who understand the individual TRU missions, who understand the uniqueness of the TRUs, but also understand this sort of common thread of the small classes, smaller approach of getting people through, the hands-on approach that we all do. But with unique differences. We have a board that will understand and embrace the fact that probably I would tell you the thing that separates us more than any of the other TRU institutions is that we have a student body that is proud of and really embraces the fact that we are among the top 10 most socially awkward universities in the country. They like that, actually. and we have a group that embraces that and understands that about our students. But that's just an indication of the types of students that we serve broadly within the state. We are still going through this transition. Our boards are still coming on. And every little cost really makes a huge difference for us. Not just the cost of the disaggregation of the system, but costs such as the Sports Action Lottery, which we use primarily to support student life, to support student athletes, to do a lot of Title IX equity within non-revenue sports. Those are important dollars for the TRU universities. There has to be a balance between direct aid to students and meaningful support. As I pointed out, we have a number of Pell-eligible, economically challenged students. They require a lot of professional staff to get them through. They require a fair amount of professional staff to get them up to speed, particularly for us. We have a large number of students coming in without necessarily the math background that they need to do so many of the things that we do. And so to support these already lean operations, we really have to have support of the infrastructure in the universities themselves for the students coming through the system. If I were to ask you all, I have a petition that came to me within the past week from a group of students.
for something that they want on campus. My guess is I could go around the room and you would never probably get to what that petition actually was for. From our students, it was for better chairs in a couple of the lecture rooms that we have. Just to give you a feeling of the kinds of things that we have that we are dealing with on the true campuses. It's fascinating. We already, I would tell you, have accomplished an awful lot as a collective group of universities, and this is all seven of us. We are collectively today, compared to 2007 and 8, educating approximately 25% more students, 20,000 more students, about 25% more students than we were in 2007 and 8, the seven public universities. And we are doing that with 17% less state support than we had at that time. And that's in absolute dollars. If you have an inflation factor of approximately 2.08% per year over that time, the state support shortage is closer to about 30%.
Yeah. Interrupt for just a moment. Representative McKinnon.
Very quick question. On your comment about growth in the system over the last number of years, which has been stunning. Do you see that as a function of people coming into the pipeline during the recession when jobs were difficult, people entered community college and are moving on through? Where do you see that trend going now that the recession is waning? Are you going to see that stay steady, increase, or is that going to start to drop off as a function of coming out of the recession?
Representative McGowan and
I'm sorry, it's McEwen, and you get a
McEwen,
pass.
I'm
it's
sorry.
Fine. Happens all the time.
McEwen and
yeah.
Chair Reed, my apologies, Representative
okay.
McEwen.
No need.
And Chair Reed, it is a complex question. Let me explain what I think the basic metrics are. We're seeing a leveling off of high school graduation rates generally in the state. We've seen some decreases in transfer student ability in the state. We have seen some additional economic factors available so that students are able to get jobs, some in apprenticeship areas. And so in some respects, we're seeing a decrease in students who are needing to go to college immediately. However, we are seeing what I have heard referred to as credential creep. And that is that, you know, in comment previously about the police and the firefighters and that crowd. One of our recent graduates who got her degree in applied psychology and played softball for us is on the Springfield Police Force, and they were not going to talk to her until she had a degree. We have a firefighter who has been a volunteer firefighter and is working in the Oregon Forestry Department, and he also needed a degree to get those job, to get that job. We're seeing more and more people need the degrees to get the jobs. So I anticipate that we're going to continue to see some increase in student enrollment, probably not at the rate that we have seen in the past, but I suspect we will have some increase in student enrollment as time goes by and there's more of a need for these credentials.
Brief follow-up.
Yes, please.
For the provost, do you see the same trend?
Representative McQueen, Chair Reed, yes, I agree with the observation that President McQueen has made.
Thank you.
I would also point out, and I'm going to refer to Provost Sabah's slide here. If you look at Provost Sabah's spider slide briefly, you will note that in many of the places where Oregon State University is doing well, that is, compared to their peers and towards the outside of those circles, as a measure of the efficiency and what we have accomplished as a set of universities already, many of the places where they are doing well is where state dollars are the denominator of a comparative metric. That is, they're getting a lot of performance out of less state support money than a lot of the peers. And I think that's an indication of how efficient and how hard the education system has been working to serve Oregonians in the state. And the TRUES are part of this package as we serve Oregonians in the state. I would tell you that each university is unique. And I'm not going to take you through the individual slides of the individual universities. What I will tell you is that the specifics for our individual universities focus generally on outreach, economically challenged students, degree completions, and the various costs of our different offerings to meet the student needs. I will tell you that the Trues serve Oregonians and are an integral part of both the promise and the potential of 404020. And if we're going to have a total Oregon solution, we need the involvement of all of Oregon's universities.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions for President Maples? Representative Johnson.
Just a quick one, and this may be something that we would hear at a later meeting on, but regarding the Trues, you know, there is a process called retrenchment that's available for universities, which is basically kind of pressing the reset button when they reach a critical need of the need to reorganize, repurpose, refocus in a way. And there are two out of the four, or how many, I guess, Trues have actually, or actually in the midst of that process, or have just recently completed. And again, you may not be the right presenter for this, but it would be good at some point to hear about how Southern and Eastern have used that process to refocus their attention to more strategically, I think, align with the needs of their region so that they can serve the needs of their students, economies, that part of Oregon. But I don't know if you just want to briefly touch on that. But then again, we might want to hear from those folks at a later date about how they've utilized that process.
Representative Johnson, Chair Reed, an excellent observation. I would tell you that if you want to hear specifics about the retrenchments, you really probably should talk to the interim presidents at both Eastern and Southern. What I can tell you is that what I promised when I came in the door almost 7 years ago was that if there was going to be substantial decreased funding, that it was not going to be spread across the board like peanut butter, that was the quickest trip to mediocrity I knew about, and that it would be focused in certain areas that were not performing well, and we would continue to enhance and even grow and develop new areas where there was potential. I think we all have embraced, to the extent that we all can, that general saying of never waste a good crisis.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Did you have a question?
Good, sorry.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. You all ask good questions, so I appreciate that. One of the implications of that is we're going to need to shift our plan a little bit, and thanks in advance to Andrea Henderson for being willing to adjust slightly. So we're going to shift Ms. Henderson's presentation to Friday when we have a little bit more time and invite Larry Large forward with hopefully a little bit more relaxation with the remaining time we have. I'm sorry it's as short as it is, but the good news is Ms. Henderson will be on Friday, so you won't feel that pressure. And we're eager to hear from you on the perspective from the nonprofits. Thanks.
I'm Larry Large, president of the Oregon Alliance of Independent Colleges and Universities, and I've taken a little different tack here based on some conversations we've had out off the record with some of you. One of the goals I hope to have today is to cover some of the broader issues in higher education, not just in Oregon. What's the industry? What's going on in that? And then how we slip into that and react to it and live with it in so many different ways. So here are some of the things that put your track shoes on, because we're going to sprint through this. I overestimated a little bit of what the content is, and I apologize if it goes too long, but we're going to do that brief environmental scan of what's going on in the industry broadly and how the media has affected that. And that's not a pejorative inclusion in this, because the media is reflecting how important this issue is and the contribution to the public good that higher education makes all across the country and all of its different kinds of institutions. Going to talk about the costs. I appreciated Executive Director Cannon this morning talking again about the cost not equaling tuition. I use the formula just a little bit differently. I use price does not equal cost. Most of the conversation is about price. and tuition or price for room and board and the other subsistence issues. I want to focus some of our time on where's the money going? What are we spending? What's the investment being made? And again, it's not to pick out certain things and say we shouldn't do that, but I think there's an inadequate, insufficient level of understanding about what some of those costs are and how important they are, but they're not what you normally think of. And this one is a governance challenge with all of the changes that are going on with shared governance, which is an important part of our industry. And so what, at the end of the day, what I'm going to say to you is next time you get a chance, hug a president. They're facing some really serious and difficult challenges.
Says the former president, yes?
Pardon?
Says the former president, right?
The outside yeah. with hugs.
Former president, even a provost.
Yes.
A provost.
Yes.
In fact, it's arguable in some ways that the provost will have a more difficult challenge. Then I want to talk to you about some of the specific things about the aggregated metrics of the 19 institutions that are make up the alliance, 11 of whom are members, and the remaining are what we call affiliates to our group, where we try to scale services and so forth. But we'll get to those. Then questions and answers as we go. Okay, the first thing to look at in the process of the scan is low revenue growth, mounting expenses, weaker operating performance is the result of all of those things. And this is Moody's telling us these things. They make the same kind of assessment when people borrow money on a bonded basis of our kinds of not-for-profit corporations as they do for other industries. So they measure this in terms of what the return is on investment for those who provide the capital. I'm going to zip through this. This is available. You can look at it later if you have it. I don't know. I assume these are distributed.
We have.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. Yep. We can all look at. Many of us are looking at them on screens.
All right. Why and when of why change is occurring in an industry that's really not had a tradition of change. You go back, we're one of the least changing things. Perhaps the Catholic Church will be competitive over centuries, but it's there. And it's been like that for a heck of a long time. Here's our strategic plan on where we're going to go. But this is my favorite slide because it tells you it's also reflects the kind of diversity that is represented in the total inventory of American higher education, let alone what you can get if you go to Europe or Asia on top of this. The media, as I said, has been after this in a lot of ways, and they've given us a bunch of new words, things that we probably didn't really talk about in any detail or any significant ways in the leadership modules on the campuses. These are all important things, and there's one down there in the penultimate line that says mergers and acquisitions. It's a term you don't hear much about, but I broadly categorize that, and we'll talk a little more about it as we go along. But talk about major and intentional collaborations that reach across campuses so that we can scale services, we can do some things that will bring the cost down, which will then ultimately reduce pressure on the price. So it's anyway, we'll make some covers with that. And across not only campuses, but across, we work with President Ed Ray and I co-hosted the second President's Collaborative 2.0 a month or so ago, not quite a month, where we bring in the community colleges, Tom Helley from Linfield College and Mary Splyde from Lane Community College were also sponsors of this last one, where we intentionally talk about how can we save each other money? How can we meet the public good interests of the state and the educational goals of 40-40-20 by working together despite our different kinds of funding sources? Okay, one of the huge cost drivers is the federal regulations, and there are two parts of this. There's both the report, the compliance part, and the reporting. There's an increased level of investment that campuses have to make just to keep track of the records of how they're comporting with regulations from all kinds. It's not a surprise, and frankly, we have to be accountable. The federal government alone is putting in, that number is now out of date. It's really 177. I was in Washington, D.C. yesterday, and those numbers have mounted to where that's a larger number. You're not going to get that kind of a distribution of assets for any industry without some kind of accountability and reporting requirement. We should have it. We have to report on graduation rates. We have to report on debt and default rates. And that's, again, these are important things to do, but it takes personnel to do that. You have to hire the people in the registrar's office, in the institutional research offices, in various other parts that you have to do it. Employment law and gainful employment rules to sustain your eligibility for what's called Title IV money, the Pell Grants, various of the federal student loans, college work study, supplemental educational opportunity grants. Here's a big one, and this is not a comprehensive list, but here is one that's emerging. We now have good faith efforts required on this starting in January of 2015 that has a very complex set of responsibilities and requirements on the campuses. This affects private colleges, community colleges, and public universities, and all other kinds of institutions that are eligible for federal funding. Very complicated. It's very expensive. Colleges are going to have to put an infrastructure in to do judiciary steps that they haven't had to have at the same level in prior times. And that's not at all, and I want to be really clear about this, to discount the importance of getting this right, because that culture has created some very serious and tragic circumstances on campuses, and we have to figure out how to manage it and change the culture to that reduces. Accreditation also takes on a huge amount of time, and it's changed in the last few years in ways that are really quite significant. The president's putting out a scorecard where he wants to rate institutions, President Obama, and it's got mixed reviews in the U.S. Congress. The reviews aren't very mixed on the campuses, however. Most of them say it's, well, we collect all of the data that go into the scorecard, but smushing it through a grinder and spitting out a single metric that somehow reflects what the quality of your institution is contrary to the fundamental issues of the diversity in American higher education that we feel important about. There are lots of others of these, but this is just a sample of some of the kinds of things that we have to report on. There are other cost drivers. When we talk about the population and the college-going cohort is reduced, there is, and tuition is a more important part of the revenue streams of colleges, mm-hmm. Colleges do compete with each other for enrollment within public universities, within private universities, across sectors, with community colleges, all of those different things. So everybody wants those best students who can pay, end up with a net tuition that at the end of the process allows the institution to function effectively. Here's one you may not think about, but you go back when I was president of the university in Atlanta, the history of that institution was that, you know, there were three personnel who would start at 6 o'clock and go to midnight, and one each day would go around and make sure the doors were locked on the residence halls. Yeah. Campus security now has training requirements. It has cars with bubbles on them, and some of them are armed, not all, very relatively few, but with an enormous new set of responsibilities, especially on that Title IX sexual assault thing, which is another new dimension of investment into the process. These are very difficult to scale. Anyway, campus security costs, if you look at an individual campus's history over 20 years, you will see a curve line that looks like that. We're corporations, and the litigation that goes on in terms of employment, all kinds of other things where there's an empowerment, and it's not inappropriate. I'm not complaining about it. It's just a fact of life that the insurance coverage and the amount of time and investment in litigation has to go. Student services. Students demand more services now, and it's also connected to the marketing thing at the top of this second list. Mm-hmm. Students, we have on a lot of campuses, virtually unscalable healthcare in infirmaries and other places, even though there can be off-campus access to facilities that can meet some of those same needs. But the culture is that it's local and in those. Counseling, that you all know the sociology, and I'm certainly not competent in that academic field. But with the divorce rates, the mixed family income, or the mixed family where there's stepchildren and other people, there's lots of pressure on it. And there's a lot of interest on the campuses to make sure that array of services is effective because of the retention rates that we all know are very important to keeping the financial health of the institution. So the student service, and then at the end of the process, we've got to do a better job with taking those post-college career directions. We've got to be able to work with the students in ways and make them career ready, not just in the skill set, but make sure that we've done the kinds of things that prepare them for that next job that they don't know they're going to have 8, 10, 15 years after graduation. We need to create that intellectual agility, that capacity to learn and to adapt to new work environments. Here's one that's a little controversial from time to time, but most athletic programs, like I'd say three standard deviations worth of academic or of athletic programs, are not self-supporting. Colleges make an investment, and for some good reasons. I'm not complaining about it, but they're lessons that are learned in life, but these things also are a source of some income. Now, here's a really big one, the technology. That's something that has grown over the last few years, not only in building the infrastructure, but the training requirements that are there. And given the short half-life of generations of different technology platforms, that's a repeatable process where you're constantly in training mode. And in higher education, where almost two-thirds of your budget is going to be in personnel, all of those people have to know. So you don't only just train them once. You've got all of the retraining cycles that go into it. And this adds up to costs that have to be met in various ways. That technology, by the way, has not always been productive in terms of improving the productivity of the academic program. And the other part of that technology is, at the top one there is marketing. Students aren't going to go to a campus where they don't have excessive bandwidth that's going to let them use their personal devices and that they can use on a personal basis that has little or nothing to do with the academic mission of the institutions. Well, what about instruction? What's happened to that over the last 15 or 20 years? Not a lot. Now, that's changing a little bit because of the technology cost. It's hard to pull out from an accounting standpoint which part of that technology increase in expense is separable from creating capacity to make us ourselves better academically than what that we'd be without it. But and some who said, you know, we should have been better at making it more productive. But I think we are. You heard the provost talk about the number of online courses. Online is here. It works. Mm-hmm. And so there are going to be returns on that investment, and sometimes it's cheaper, but not always, depending on how it's structured. It's a myth sometimes to think that automatically online instruction produces a lower per credit hour result. The demographics we're looking at, they're going to be, because of the income combinations and all of that, I'm just going to put these up here. You can see them. Here's the mergers and acquisition thing. I'm mindful of your time, and I want to get to some other issues here. We are an industry that's come late to the data party. We're working on it. I think there are lots more things now where we're trying to collect data to be able to answer good questions from this committee and other committees of Congress and state legislators around the country. There's always a danger about the privacy concerns in this. But I think the value added from good data analytics will trump the privacy questions as long as we do a good job of protecting those with every way possible. Representative Reardon earlier on asked a question about the students and starting in the seventh grade to be able to. Yeah, I remember transferring from grade school in Malala, Oregon to Mill City, and I had to carry a little 3x5 card when I transferred. This is a long time ago, that had my shot records on it. Mm-hmm. I think there's a digital equivalent in our future that will say, starting in the seventh grade, here are the courses I've taken. Here's, you know, I can change my mind, but this is a little bit what I'm interested in. It can make us more efficient even in the 9th through 12th grades and in the college area, and it's better than random if we can get some indication of what the goals are and get people thinking about college and their future early, because we need students in the equation. I think they're the silent partner in this right now, and that's not to their advantage. These are things where we have to keep records on. The tuition has gained way more, but more importantly, it's outstripped family income. It's not just that it's outstripped inflation. And it's taking over, as you've heard from others, in every one of our kinds of sectors, that tuition is taking more, proportionally more of the burden than before. But we still subsidize students in all of those areas. I'm going to skip this slide. You can look at it. What it basically shows you is the changing variables of different kinds of institutions over a 10-year period, that more of it is coming from. It just makes the point graphically that tuition is picking up a bigger piece. But this one I want you to look at. This is looking at family income. And from all of these other areas, there's been the lowest quintile is the blue one there. You can see it. That look at what happened in the 2002 to 2012 period of time. Now, that's a larger and growing cohort of the students whom we are going to be serving in higher education going along. So we got to grow. We got to make sure we're taking care of a higher proportion of the students, even though than we have in the past. And we've got to confront the cost issues. Compensation is always one of those. We can skip this one. This is a survey of how many people have, from presidents and chief financial officers around the country, think we can enhance revenues. These are opinions from within the operating leadership of the campuses. I want to take a minute here and go follow up on my earlier comment about hug a president when you get a chance. It's changed a lot. It wasn't very long ago that you could say, mm-hmm. I'm a president. You ask him, what's the most important thing you do? And she'll say, or he'll say, raise money. It's still important, but it's not the same importance that it used to be. Because of all of the swirling that's going on and national attention on the industry, you have to look at where you're going to strategically position your institution. And then when you do that, then you've got to go out and you've got to create learnable moments for your faculty. Because they are, I never say teachable moments with faculty, that's not very good idea. But we create these opportunities where you get the institution leadership and the faculty to become really good students of the industry and then become extraordinarily good students of their campus to make sure that they're operating at the optimal level and they're serving the students whom they can serve best. Then when you get that done, you got to have that aligned with, guess what? There's a third stool, leg to this stool. It's called the Board of Trustees. And we all now, recently, we all have those. All the public community colleges and the privates all have those. So you have to have those things there. And you have to be, the presidents have to be accountable to these things. And you also have to have the ability to have your be able to engage in these conversations. You can't just write a blog once a week or speak at the convocation. You've got to get in and engage the folks so they really know what's happening. The boards, I've said this in a number of different settings, it's not the responsibility of boards of trustees to lead the innovation curve, but they have to be certified smart about it in order to help the institutions make good decisions and avoid bad decisions when it comes to evaluating and initiating new things. Okay, now to the part I came for. 43% of the students at the institutions that I represent come from Oregon. We have 19% of the total enrollment in the state at the undergraduate level. We do grant 23% of degrees. We get them through, on average, a little faster than the public sector does.
Just a moment. Representative Williamson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The alliance, the students, it's good to hear the makeup. Do you have for-profit university institutions at all?
No, we do not. These are all not-for-profit, accredited. A regionally accredited institution, not just professionally accredited, but regionally accredited like the public universities.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure.
Okay.
I understood.
We can't quite match the 70% that I heard earlier from President Maples, but we certainly can do better than the 7 to 12%. We're educating a very significant portion of the low-income students in the state. 32% of our students are Pell eligible, and that we're educating the Oregon demographic very much in the similar ways that a lot of the public institutions are doing. And we give a lot of financial aid. And surprising to some, because liberal arts, the term has been hijacked by the media over the last few years. So in this case, I will be critical. Liberal arts include sciences, by the way. It's humanities, social science, and science. And so we actually produce 21% of the STEM degrees that are harvested each year across the state. 49% of the students stay in Oregon when they graduate, so there's a good return on that investment. We contribute to the workforce. 30% of the undergraduate degrees in mathematics are produced by, in the aggregate, from our institutions. You can see these other numbers. The nursing one is a big number. Then at the graduate level, these are also big numbers. We have a lot of the business degrees. And in the teacher education area, which is one of the new ones under new regulations at the federal level, there's going to be something we have to address. Okay. We have, I think, 8% of the Oregon Opportunity Grant money comes to students who are at one or another of the Alliance institutions. And these students, we're very proud to say, they track very closely the normal cohort of the average for the students, and that's not true normally of the lower income students. So we're very pleased about the ability to do that. And our students, by the way, have to meet the same need requirements as any student going to Chemeketa or to Eastern Oregon University, any of those things. They have to meet the same need test in order to be eligible for it. These numbers, like Ben Cannon said to you, we couldn't agree more. We've got to get better at getting students through at a faster pace. I read a study recently that there's $175,000 difference in the overall cost of a lifetime of taking 6 years instead of four, because you calculate the foregone income, the additional tuition, and the additional subsistence costs, books, all of those different things. We have to be more efficient in that. And that's true of our institutions just as it is the public ones. These rates are good. We like the fact that, you know, comparatively they're good. They're not good enough. We need to be better. Here's some class sizes that you ask us to do. Most of our classes are between 10 and 29 students, and those two breakdowns there. We do have three classes over 100. I couldn't tell you where they are or what they're about, but there they are. And unfortunately, from an economic standpoint, we have 20% of our classes with fewer than 10 students in them, and that's, well, excellent education experience. It's economically a challenge, as you can see. We run about 12 to 1. Those are, you can see what those are. Those are aggregated numbers. We discount tuition mightily. So let's just give you some numbers of that. Let's say we had our tuition was $1,000 for a semester. The students end up paying, $580 on average. It's quite a range, and there's a wage of tuition discounting that means some of the students are paying full price, others are paying virtually zero net of their other eligibility for financial aid. We typically work with students on a work-study program to where they're contributing partners to the process on campus. There's lots of different sources of aid here. Student debt. Our numbers are pretty good. Our average student debt when you come out is $28,000 a year for a bachelor's degree.
$28,000 total, not per year, right?
No, total.
Yes,
total.
Thank you.
That's what it comes out to. And our default rate, we work with our students and do financial counseling on the campus to make sure they know what they're signing and so forth. We're still not 100% successful at that, but we use outside agencies to deliver some of that, something called SALT. I couldn't tell you what it stands for, but it's an organization that helps financial literacy for students who are on financial aid of one kind or another. I said 28, it's 28.5. We believe in making sure the student is engaged in the process. And that's something, it's not only on the financial aid, but we've got a program that we're very proud of called the Match College Savings Plan, where students have to give, they can have to give a minimum of $1,100 in savings. We can match that five times by using other sources of income. We alone at the Alliance have externally, independent of the colleges, we've raised $986,000 in 4 years to be a part of that match. these kids really get through well. And I say kids, that's not the appropriate term, because a lot of them are working adults who've gone back to college and are doing it. But that program has been really good. Anyway, I've almost made it. Sorry.
Very impressive. Very well. 25 slides and a lot of good information. Representative McEwen has been patiently waiting in the queue, and then we'll come to Representative.
And actually, please. Sir, we're running late. I can bring this up at another time, unless you would like me to.
Well, fortunately, we have a few extra minutes for those who can stay. I've been assured that there is not another committee waiting for us, and I should start really by thanking you, Dr. Large, for making. I know you came back from the East Coast for our meeting, so grateful that you're here, and I don't want to cut the conversation short, so I can stay for a few
minutes. This can be a very short conversation. It's just something I'd like to get on the radar and ask what your view of it is, and it's MOOCs.
Yes.
I know on the East Coast these are becoming something that are providing an opportunity for students to take coursework. They don't end up with a degree, but they have the skills to go into the workforce. Doesn't really fit into our 40-40-20 because we're looking for that degree designation. But can you tell me how this is beginning to fly? It's gaining some traction.
Yeah. Chair Reed and Representative McEwen, MOOCs are important. They're an important element. They are not the panacea to solve the problem. Most of the people in the MOOCs now are those who already have graduate degrees. They're educational entertainment and continuing education for a lot of people. But we can learn from this. And they're not succeeding in terribly monetizing ways. But we can learn that model and learn ways to scale the services and outsource some of the instruction and save money in the long run. So I am glad the MOOCs have been on the scene. We need to learn from them, correct it, find adaptable ways in which it can be incorporated into the delivery. One of the things that's important, in higher education we do two things. We make people smarter, but we also certify people to be smart. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to lose that. Just collecting merit badges from academic experiences, this can go on with this. We want to be able to have a coherence where somebody says, this is what a graduate from Linfield College knows, or what a graduate from Reed knows, or what a graduate from Oregon Institute of Technology knows. Being able to use this technology and its experience to our advantage on campus is a possibility. I don't know exactly how it's going to work, but I'm an optimist about it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Gallegos?
Thank you. Dr. Large, Monday, I guess it was. I lost track of days already. But I think it was Monday we had a presentation by Ms. Burns on, and one of the really strong variables that sort of popped out was advising as sort of really making a difference. And I know that like the difference between private schools and public schools, advising is really sort of one of the major differences. And it'd be interesting in your analysis to look at advising as both a cost as in terms of student education, but also the expense for. But we can look at that some other time, I guess.
Okay, and Chair Reed, it is important. But the critical ingredient from my perspective is we need that student engagement at the table and that planning and that commitment to do it. And we also could cut down the time to graduation with good advising, not just because they're on course, but they're more efficient in the courses they select, and you have fewer courses credits over and above the minimum for graduation. That's where a lot of other costs are incurred, sort of under the radars.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Larry, thank you for that great report, and I really do appreciate your broad depth of not just local knowledge, but national, so we can see where we're at. But I really appreciated your comments about how the services that students expect and, I guess, even demand regarding living conditions and learning environments is vastly different than it was 30 or 40 years ago, which is a driver of cost, certainly.
That's
which
right.
Lends to the value of what OIT has done with the Wilsonville campus, where you bring the learning environment to the area where the students are, because those degrees are able to be offered at a lower cost than if they would be on a campus where they have to provide all the services. But I also want to give you a quick plug for what you've been involved with doing through Linfield with our Hooter Valley High School, with making online courses available for students in our high school to take, which are full Linfield accredited courses that are benefiting some students. So thanks for being a part of that innovation.
Oh, Representative Johnson, Chair Reed, I appreciate that, and it's something we're interested in. We're trying to make sure that those courses are at the full collegiate level, so that if they take writing or math 101 there, that we want them, if they go to Linfield or to Reed to take 102, right, that they're co-equal with the, exactly, the others from those areas.
Thank you.
Excellent.
Thank you very much. Yeah. The good news, committee is Dr. Large is based in Oregon, so we can call on him again from time to time, I hope. I'm sorry we cut off sort of short here, but you did a great job. We appreciate
Thank
it.
You. You
and we'll pick up on Friday with Ms. Henderson on the community college perspective, and then we'll get to take on our first bills.
Good.
So we're going to start at 8:30 on Friday with a little bit later start. We'll see you on Friday. Thanks.
Group caucus.
We're adjourned.
Horses.
Those are my pastor pets.
Really?
Pastor pets.
Really?